Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. It's March 5th. We'll start with the continuation of our public hearing on House Bill 2598. We have four people who didn't have a chance to testify on Tuesday, so we'll start with that. Invite Elise Brown and Roger Martin forward if you'd like to come share your comments, please. Since you're here first, Mr. Martin, go right ahead.
I prefer that she have the opportunity. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. I want to make a general statement that the Catholic... So because we're on a subject that is, I think, very technical and very difficult for all of us, you need to understand, and I want to make it clear, the Catholic Church supports the idea and the practice of stem cell research. Our one concern is the use of embryonic stem cells. I don't need to lecture anybody. We are opposed to that use. We do see the great value in stem cell research. This is a highly political issue. I don't need to tell you that. It's been the topic in the press and in scientific circles and in national conventions of a lot of talk and consideration. I would hope that the discoveries in this field in the last, virtually the last months, might negate the need to specifically use embryonic stem cells. I have grave concerns about that part of it. But I do want you to know we support it. You will hear shortly from Dr. Gregory at St. Vincent's Hospital. That's a Catholic institution. And there he's done great work in the area of stem cells. So I want to make that clear. Most people don't understand, including most Catholics, have no idea what the whole issue is about. And it's an educational process. I would caution you, in the bill, there's a statement on page 3 of the bill, and again in the proposed amendments, about a policy, referring to it as if there is a current policy in state government. I believe there is no current policy. It would seem to me that part of what you're trying to do is form a committee that will bring back to this legislature a policy that will set the policy for the use in the state of Oregon. I would also caution you, in my opinion, I've been around here for a long time, if I were putting any kind of an agency anywhere, the Department of Human Services wouldn't be where I would put it. They're upside down trying to do the current functions they're assigned. What you will get for $140,000 is a staff person who will probably have some other duties and won't have much time, and a backup assistant. I would also have to, as the young man said from Central Catholic the other day, question, having gone through the session you just went through on the floor of the House, the idea of an expenditure of some additional amount of money, I think, would be difficult. It might be well to try to establish this stem cell research, and I hope in establishing it, people like Dr. Gregory will be seriously considered for membership. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Brown.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Elise Brown for the American Diabetes Association in Oregon. And I appreciate the opportunity to be back here again today. We certainly were very enthusiastic and supportive of the bill last session, working with Rep. Galizio on a similar bill. So we're back to tell you, for the record, that we support this bill this time. And I, too, appreciated the testimony yesterday of the student from Central Catholic, Go Rams, because he did bring up a good point about the cost and the fiscal, but it's my responsibility today to tell you, just in the name of all those in Oregon with diabetes, that the cost to Oregon is huge for health care. And without a cure and without the ability to advance more research, the cost to Oregon and those with diabetes is going to continue to grow. So to put that in perspective, I just wanted to share with you some numbers that I think are very relevant. 1 in 15 adults have been diagnosed with diabetes in Oregon, which is a prevalence that's higher than the national average. So I think that's scary. 6,900 develop diabetes each year in Oregon. So the total cost of diabetes for people in Oregon right now is $2,181,000. So again, I ask you to consider this bill I think it's important for those with diabetes and for future and health and livelihood for the state of Oregon. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Are there questions for Representative Thatcher?
Elise. Yes. I'm sorry, I just blanked on your name. You just mentioned the cost of diabetes. Is that directly to the state itself, or is that just the cost to the people aggregate in the state who have diabetes?
That's a very good question. It's a mix of the two. You know, there's a cost to the state of Oregon for those that are uninsured, and there's the cost to manage the disease for those that have it, whether they have insurance or not. So it's a combination of the two.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Our last two witnesses, appropriately, are perhaps the best qualified to speak to the issue from some experience. So, Dr. Gregory and Dr. Nguyen, appreciate you coming back since we kept it kind of short with you last time. So, perhaps since we've heard from you a little bit, we could start with Dr. Gregory.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Gregory, cardiologist, physician, founder and director of the Oregon Center for Regenerative Medicine. I'm one of the four program directors for the recently created Armed Forces Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which is a $250 million program to bring stem cell regenerative therapies to our injured servicemen and women. I do research involving autologous stem cells at Providence St. Vincent's, where we have our center. Oregon, I'm a faculty member of the Oregon Health Sciences University, Oregon Graduate Institute, and do research at PSU, OSU, and Legacy in stem cell research. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2598. I think it's essential and absolutely important that Oregon get on board and formally recognize and organize a public discourse. We need to enact appropriate safety regulations for the public, and we also need to provide support for ongoing stem cell research so that we can offer these benefits that's going to affect every medical and surgical patient in the future. It's a profound new field. We all have our stem cells, and they're essential for all of our healing. And unfortunately, the limited regenerative capacity that we all have, that diminishes as we get older, as some of us know a little more than others. I think that while I do my research exclusively with autologous stem cells, your own stem cells, and we do research mainly working with stem cells that are in your bone marrow, which is the central repository, if you will, for the healing in our body and the regenerative capacity in our body. So we can definitively show, and we have shown in laboratories here in Oregon, that we can take bone marrow stem cells and fairly easily help them transdifferentiate, if you will, into skeletal muscle cells. We're developing this program to help regenerate arm and leg tissue for our soldiers who have been injured from blast injuries from IED. We're using stem cells. We've shown that you can use stem cells to create Schwann cells and nerve cells. We have a funded program for spinal cord and nerve regeneration. We have a funded program for heart regeneration using autologous bone marrow stem cells. We hope to be offering treatments to our patients here in Oregon this year in 2009 as part of an international clinical trial. You have to recall that regenerative medical therapies using autologous cells have been in place worldwide for almost 10 years now. Thousands of patients have been treated and treated safely without any reported complications after 10 years of monitoring, without formation of tumors, and treating in a very unstable situation, which is an acute myocardial infarction or a heart attack. So I think that they have shown in randomized sham-controlled trials that if you get your own stem cells right before you go home after a heart attack, you can show heart regeneration, improved function with less heart failure, and definitely improve survival. So it's going to be a very important therapy that we need to bring here to Oregon. We also have programs that are funded that help with skin regeneration after burns and skin injuries. We need to grow these programs. We need to support them, and we need to support them safely. I think it's important to also not avoid, but consider embryonic stem cell research. Although we don't do that here, because I see that as a far-off horizon in terms of treatment, there's a lot of very significant, important problems, I think, that have to be identified and solved. But I think this is important for us to not turn our backs on, but create an open forum for discussion and support. And I have submitted a summary statement at this point. I'm going to just say that I overwhelmingly support your efforts in bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Dr. Gregory. I know you are on a very tight schedule, so let's see if there are any questions for you right now. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I probably should have asked this question previously of Mr. Martin coming up, because he's made me think about this as far as establishing this committee within the Department of Human Services. I'm curious what your take on where this particular committee should be housed. I mean, would it fit better in OHSU by itself, or do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I'm shooting from the hip here, but my recommendation, since more than, as I've said, that there are several academic institutions that are actively pursuing stem cell research, and I think every hospital will have a program, not just, you know, every university in this country has a program or developing a program. I think that it's my recommendation to this committee that this be an independent committee rather than within any one institution, and it be comprised of a collaborative group of scientists from different disciplines in medicine and surgery, as well as basic science, and people from the outside community. So I don't think it should be at Providence or OHSU or OSU. I think it should be an independent committee that's not unduly influenced by any one of us.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to say, Doctor, that I'm totally ignorant when it comes to this area, and I feel out of my depth completely, but that seems to be the case in many of my committees, so I'm going to go ahead and ask you some questions. I talked to a doctor this morning, a PhD down in Texas at Baylor, with whom kind of a relation, and asked him some questions about this issue. He indicated that if I would go on a website, clinicaltrials.gov, I would find 2,442 clinical trials, and of those, I could count on one hand the ones that involved embryonic stem cells. And he alluded to the point you, I think, were making, which is that this is a very, very complex area, and one that requires, in his words, a huge financial commitment, that if we're going to be serious about funding that type of activity, the state of Oregon needs to get its act together and put a lot more money into it than, in his opinion, we have done. He also, get to the point. He indicated that one of the stimulus packages that's coming out of Washington, D.C., that many different medical schools are trying to get their houses in order so they can obtain some of that money. And I just wonder, in your opinion, is that what the state of Oregon is currently doing? Because, and I'll ask that question, and I have one follow-up.
That's fine.
Well, that's where the money is this year in the stimulus package, as far as I know. And we're obviously scrambling to get proposals ready here in Oregon. I'm putting together a proposal for a traumatic brain injury with scientists at Providence, at Legacy, and the VA hospital. And we do have a submission ready proposal. We're getting another one together, and these would be with allogenic, which is other human or adult stem cells, not embryonic stem cells. So yes, we are doing our best to get in the line. I'm working with a lobbyist in Oregon in Washington, D.C. I'm going to be there next week, trying to hustle some money out of Washington for Oregon, and again, for all the different institutions. So yes, we are working very much to get our hands on some of that stimulus money that's directed towards medical research, and hopefully we can bring some home to Oregon. I'm not pushing embryonic stem cells, me personally, although I know that other folks, primarily from OHSU, are doing working in that area.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, please. Thank you. The point that I think is of greatest interest to me is where we, in a small state like Oregon, appropriately allocate our financial resources. The PhD out of Texas indicated that the stimulus money was a one-time thing in all likelihood, and that it should be appropriately allocated because it would be maybe inappropriate to allocate it to something that we didn't have financial support to follow up upon. And in this day of shrinking budgets, his point seemed to be place your bets wisely. My question to you is this. In the bill, there is a committee created that is to establish guidelines. And who actually will, given your view of that bill, be making decisions on how the money is then allocated? And what would it be normal for a committee of this nature to make recommendations to OHSU, or is that something OHSU would decide and then maybe go to the committee saying we've decided this is where we want to place the dollars? I'm trying to get at who makes the decisions on how these dollars are allocated.
I think that's a very critical decision, and I would expect that you all would set those guidelines. I think that if you have the appropriate medical and scientific membership on that committee, as well as lay membership, which I think is very important, you would be able to come to a conclusion better than some of us who have got our nose in the problem and are passionate in our own particular approach to make the best bet. But I would have good, senior, balanced people who could give good investment advice, if you will, on that committee, and do it independent of any of the academic institutions here in Oregon. Probably, to my knowledge, almost all of them are working with stem cells in one biomedical approach or another. I think I'm working with most of them in stem cell research myself, and I'm not the only one. I think that, I don't know if you asked me this question, but I'm going to put it out there. I agree with your colleague in Texas that the investment the public will need to make to bring practical and safe embryonic stem cell forward is going to be very, very considerable, both in absolute dollars and time. I think that my guess is there is a very important publication just came out this last week that showed for the first time a tumor developed in a child that was given fetal stem cells, which are similar, which is a sad case. Tumors that formed in the spinal cord and the brain that are inoperable. This was done outside this country, and sad story. I can give you that reference. I think that's going to slow things down, and possibly that's a reasonable thing. So if I was to, and I have limited resources. I have to make this go through the same decision process that you all will hopefully set up, and that is where can I get the biggest bang earliest to bring things forward and really help people, but help people safely. And so what I'm pricing my bets, and I'm placing my bets with the public, with the taxpayers' money, and I try to be a good steward, is that I'm doing something with your own stem cells, autologous stem cells, to really amplify and magnify the body's right now very limited ability to replace and regenerate tissues or organs. And so I'm placing my bets on autologous stem cell sources, non-amplified, because I am afraid of malignant transformation. When a stem cell turns bad or has a malignant transformation, that's a very difficult animal to deal with, if you will.
Thank you, Doctor. And just a remark, that was that you just paraphrased what the conversation was from Texas this morning. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Dr. Reed, Representative Gillian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, some for coming back, some for being here for the first time. I want to repeat here, especially for you, Doctor, that I am very appreciative of our chair and our vice chair at a very important part of legislation here that we are in. A very contentious parts of it can be very contentious at setting the tone for civility and for honestly trying to get at things. So I just want to repeat that, and I'll repeat it as many times as I need to because I appreciate it very much. We have some differences in core beliefs and the way we approach this, but I want to ask you, first thing I want to ask you is, may I use autologous and adult stem cell interchangeably as words follow up? As regards adult stem cell research, which I'm grateful for your research in that, particularly as it relates to our veterans, but for all the folks that you're trying to help, if you had to choose, and I'm not asking you to, but if you had to, would it obviously be the one you would prefer, the where you would put the most hope, that taxpayers' dollars, however you want to put that, versus embryonic, or can they be separated in your mind?
That's where I put my bet. I appreciate the fact that there's a lot of religious, legal, political, and scientific controversy. And as someone who's worked in this field for 12 years, the scientist, we're duking it out, and it sometimes it's not very civil. So there's still a lot of ignorance, and there's still a lot of, and unfortunately, a lot of hype, and some of it, I think, comes from us scientists. So guys like me usually blame, you know, you all and people, you know, religions and everybody getting involved. Everybody should be involved throughout society in stem cells because it's going to be important to all of us. Your stem cells are critical for your very well-being. So it's a discourse that many times is filled with hyperbole and disinformation and misinformation, and just as much in our among us, God. And we all, what we fight for this year is wrong the next year. But I think this is very important to finding truth and then finding a good therapy. I've clearly put my bet on near-term horizon, meaning treating patients this year and the next couple of years, on using adult stem cells or autologous stem cells, your own stem cells, because there's a proven safety record of 10 years in people and a great deal of safety in animal studies, and large animal, non-human primates. I think the first thing we need to do is do things safely. Once those cells are in, you know, they're hard, you can't pull them back. So I do think that there is promise for embryonic stem cells. I think that's a further out horizon. There's a lot of questions about how they work in people, or will they work, and will they be have significant complications. So I'm making my bet for the next few years on autologous cells, and we hope to bring these forward.
May I do one more?
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this committee moved ahead with a slightly altered, amended bill, and we decided that the committee definitely should be formed, and we agree on the makeup and so forth, do you feel like the committee could contribute something in this area if, as a first phase, as a limitation, they were agreeing on what we can agree on, which is adult stem cell potential, and work on what I sense is fantastic potential that we have undiscovered. You think a committee could move ahead without being hampered in some professional way by that kind of a focus?
I think that we as a state should, I think doing nothing, coming out and saying nothing, is not where we should go. I think we have to move forward. It would be so moving forward, standing still should not be an option. Moving forward, even if we take a small step, if we can all step forward, that's a very significant step forward that has to be taken for us as a state. I'm on the board of trustees at USC, and you know, they're getting tens of millions of dollars of state from the California Regenerative, you know, that billion, multi-billion dollar thing. And these are our, you know, these are our competitors, and the things that they can do. And we're not talking billions of dollars of support, but we need to at least move forward. Even if it's a small step, we should do something. Doing nothing, well, it's embarrassing. It's the wrong thing to do. And so somehow there needs to be some, there is common ground out here, and we have to identify it and move forward. And then the answer is the social, religious, legal issues about stem cells, they're not going to be solved this next year. It's a complex and important problem. But we need to make some progress moving forward. So any progress forward is the right thing to do. Okay. Can you solve all the problems, answer all the problems this year? No, I don't think that will happen. And it probably shouldn't happen. These are things that are going to take a lot of consideration for many different groups. So,
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I noted he was, our guest is from Salem. We might want to inform him where USC is located.
Dr. Nguyen, would you like to...
Can I ask?
Representative,
sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gregory, thank you again for taking the time out of your busy day, busy schedule. And I've had the opportunity to visit Dr. Gregory at one of the clinics, and it was really fascinating, so I appreciate it. My question is, from your perspective as a research scientist, at this point, do we have definitive proof or a definitive answer to say right now that embryonic stem cell research should no longer take place? And do you think politicians should be the ones making that decision?
Well, I'm taking a couple seconds to reply, but that's not to mean any hesitation. The answer is we do need to continue to do embryonic stem cell research. There is no question in my mind. There is great potential there, but there's great, you know, for those of you who are Star Wars fans, there's always a dark side. If you have a great force for good, it can go the other way. So I think we need to understand both of those and make that investment, because embryonic stem cell therapies are going to move forward worldwide, whether we as a state embrace them or become involved with them or regulate them or discuss them in an open, fair place. It will move forward, and our academic institutions, our hospital systems, we need to know firsthand, not secondhand. We read papers that are biased, or you know, we need to know here in Oregon what's good and what's bad, what should be done, what should go forward, what should we be afraid of, and so we need to be involved. Being involved secondhand, and this field is moving so fast, and it's moving in all directions. We can't just wait and listen to the research done elsewhere. We need to be involved with it. So categorically, emphatically, yes, we need to be involved with this. Should we have the right cautions and precautions that are put forward by folks that are one step removed? Yes, I think that those need to, you all, we need you involved. You represent public safety. It's my integral job of first doing no harm. But it's always good to have oversight, and we welcome that.
Thank you. There are other questions we'll ask Dr. Nguyen. If you'd like to
thank you,
bring us back up to speed. Thanks.
Reed and Representative Galizio and Representative Benz for having me. My name is Michael Nguyen. Pardon me, I've got this cough. I'm a neurologist practicing here in Salem. I trained at Oregon Health Sciences University and opened my practice here in 1997. I'll take just a couple minutes, please, first to commend my colleague on excellent research. That's exactly what we need in this state, and we need a lot more of it. And actually, much of this will echo what Dr. Gregory has already mentioned. I might phrase it a little bit differently. From the hearing on Tuesday, it seems there have been two main concerns about this bill, or at least expressed about the potential use or uncontrolled use of embryonic stem cells. So we'll talk about that for a minute, and also I'll just ask or mention something about policy aspects of this bill. So as I reread the bill, and I am by no means an expert reading these kind of bills, but this bill actually should encourage those who have concerns about embryonic stem cell research because, as you just said, Dr. Gregory, it actually sets up a framework. That's exactly what we should have, a committee to go through these definitions, to set up standards and guidelines. That's precisely what the state should do. And that should actually, again, reassure people who have concerns about use of embryonic stem cells. It also sends, I think, a powerful message to researchers nation and worldwide, because these days, researchers will they'll switch countries, where they'll go where the good research can be done. It says, you can come to Oregon and you can do research here on comprehensive stem cell research, but we're going to be watching you, and you're going to kind of do it within our framework. And I think quality researchers appreciate that, and you even touched on this, Dr. Gregory. They want to know the rules of the game. I was a co-investigator on a number of stroke trials, you know, so human subject stroke trials, and we were just, as all are, very concerned about, you know, making an honest mistake with processing of information, things like that. Because if you do that, then the IRB, the Internal Investigation Review Board, will come down on you hard, and they'll shut you down today. So now you're losing money and time. So any quality researcher is acutely aware of this, and they will appreciate actually having a committee put together a framework. So I think that's a strength of this bill. Another issue, I guess, briefly about the biology, is it seems like the committee has been told that any embryonic stem cell research is a one-way street to implantation therapy. That is not true. Embryonic stem cells have a unique genetic mechanism and apparatus, because remember, they're coming from 128 or, you know, 50 to 200 cell mass, and they are not differentiated. They can form anything. So their on and off switches in their genes are completely different than an adult stem cell. That's a unique situation. There are many neurodegenerative diseases and cancers where these on and off regulatory genes play a crucial role in that disease. We don't understand that very well. So studying an embryonic stem cell, studying that mechanism, can lead to treatments that have nothing to do with implantation. We can learn more about genetics of disease. And that's not only for treatment genetically, but also diagnostic tests. One of the major difficulties we have in neurology is, wouldn't it be nice to diagnose someone with Alzheimer's years before they become symptomatic? So studying embryonic stem cells is much more than just, let's see how we can put them into someone as implantation. Much, much more. So that's why I would encourage you to remember that and realize that there's greater potential there. And I think, actually, I'm going to stop about there. What about cost and resources, though? I think it's $140,000-some-odd. And an old man, older than me, once said, you know, you shouldn't step over dollars to pick up pennies. Dr. Gregory mentioned one of your programs is a $250 million program. So, you know, I mean, in this day and age, pretty much any grant, medical grant, starts at $500,000 and goes up from there rapidly. So a bill that would directly cost the state of Oregon $140,000-$150,000 is, I know dollars count, but that's a pretty good investment for what can bring in. I think also concerned citizens need to realize that as I read this bill, it's not you all are not going to start writing checks for research with state money, not at all. So I think that's maybe a misperception on some concerned citizens' parts. So I'll stop right there and take questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wynn. We have just a few minutes for questions. Representative Glizio.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Wynn. Two questions. And one is, could you briefly just talk about the significance of a public investment vis-a-vis mm-hmm. obtaining private research or mm-hmm. grant research? And then the second one, it sounds to me is what you were describing, because, you know, Dr. Gregory talks about the hype, and everyone wants cures to ALS, right. Parkinson's, you know, you can go down the list, and that's what right. we're hoped. But it sounds like what you're saying is, in other words, within this research on all different types of stem cells, part of its significance is in perhaps unanticipated or, in other words, other areas of research that we might discover that we just don't know, and that's a major import of this kind of research. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was mentioned that there are very few clinical trials for embryonic stem cell research, and again, that's because it hasn't been done in this country for 8 or 9 or 10 years to speak of, at least. But absolutely, any scientific investigation that starts to answer question A, you will learn knowledge that then brings up question B and C, and you'll advance your knowledge base. Discoveries, unintended discoveries, happen all the time. And so since, I think, at least in this country, embryonic comprehensive stem cell research has been somewhat limited, let's put it that way, I think it's a wide open, very exciting area for what unexpected advances we'll learn. And I'm sorry, your first question?
Oh, it was just about the significance of a public, if the state were to make an investment, what's the significance?
I think it sends a message. It says Oregon wants to be, you know, proactive. We want to be part of this incredibly important area, but we're going to do it our way. You're going to have to, you know, pay attention to what the committee and the legislature comes up with. I think that's a very nice, balanced message about this kind of research.
And your point, Representative Galizio, is not necessarily just a financial investment, but the investment of time and other resources as well, right?
Well said.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Dr. Wynn, you mentioned that there have been very few clinical trials in this country, mm-hmm. which makes me wonder if there's been any ongoing clinical trials or successes found in other countries.
I think there have been some. I'm not aware of any great successes, but again, if the question is, you know, why don't we have a cure for X, Y, and Z from embryonic stem cells, we've had some bad outcomes because there needs to be more research done to understand why those bad outcomes occurred. But I guess it gets back to another issue about IRBs and unsuccessful research. Internal review boards, they watch very closely when clinical trials with humans are done. And it's not a case of the investigator says, well, here's my protocol, and they say, come back 2 years and tell us what you learned. They're, you know, every 6 months. It's called a data safety monitoring committee. And I've been involved in studies or read about studies where if the trend even looks bad, they stop the study right away. I can't imagine, based upon what Dr. Gregory just said and what we've heard before, that some investigators are going to say, oh, I'm going to definitely go for implantation this year. I agree completely. That's not a good, wise use of resources, because the trend seems to be not a productive area of research. They're not going to do it. I hope that gets at that question, kind of, sort of.
Yeah,
sort
of.
Did you want to make a comment, Dr. Gregory?
Well, just to amplify and give an example, and if I'm violating protocol, I'm sorry about that. One of the important properties of stem cells, whether they're autologous, adult, or embryonic, that a lot of people don't realize or recognize, is that they have a profound ability to modulate and regulate our inflammatory response. And if we think about all these soldiers that are injured with traumatic brain injury, for example, the brain damage, the permanent brain damage, is really not done by the acute shock. It's the secondary inflammatory response, mm-hmm. if I may speak in a neurologic standpoint.
Certainly.
And so if we can study how, and that's one of the grant proposals we have, is how stem cells can modulate and prevent an adverse inflammatory response and learn how the stem cells do it, we probably don't even need to implant the stem cells. We can figure out how these guys do it with what mediators and use those mediators to prevent degenerative disease, traumatic brain injury, stroke problems, just to talk about the neurologic ones.
That's helpful. Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you get away, Dr. Gregory, I wanted to ask you two quick questions. First is, are you familiar with Sherry Stock and the Brain Injury Association of Oregon? Sherry Stock from Malala. Offline, I want to get you connected with her. She was sort of the reason that we passed a resolution last session that March is Brain Awareness Injury Month in Oregon, and her work on a volunteer basis from a charitable sort of nonprofit side might be of interest to you as well. You guys should team up, and I'll work on you with that. My quick follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair, is I'm going to ask this of some other folks later, I hope, but I wanted to ask you, because of your experience in research, have you run across what would be termed an articulated or a directive from the state of Oregon regarding a state policy on embryonic or adult stem cell research?
No, I have not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. There are other questions? Thank you both very much. You've done a good job amplifying what we heard on Tuesday, and really appreciate your expert perspective. perspectives.
Thank you.
I think it's obviously an issue that we'll continue to talk about, and we'll probably be taking it up again soon. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2598 and open public hearing on House Bill 2740. Representative Bruin, thank you very much for your patience. Please come forward and note we have Christina McNitt and Chris Darcy also signed up, and while you're getting scheduled, maybe if you could give us a quick summary.
Certainly. HB 2740 increases the number of members of the Cultural Trust Development Board and specifies their term length, extends the period during which monies collected from the surcharge for issuance of cultural registration license plates and transferred to the Trust for Cultural Development Account may be used for marketing and promotion, extends the Trust Community Cultural Participation Grant Program through July 1, 2021, clarifies that grants be awarded only to cultural coalitions with approved cultural plans, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009.
Thank you. Representative Bruin, thanks again for your patience.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for getting me in. Thank you, committee. Good afternoon. I'm Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37, which is primarily Westland and Tualatin. And I also have the privilege, as well as being a state representative, of having served on the Oregon Cultural Trust Board for about the last 3.5 years, and myself and Senator Dingfelder are the two legislative appointees to the trust. House Bill 2740, which you have before you today, proposes to do three things. First, it expands the Cultural Trust Board of Directors from 7 to 11 members in order to actively involve more people on the ground raising money for the Oregon's arts, heritage, and humanities. And this is especially important given the current economic times we're in. And it also, I mean, I say this sort of tongue-in-cheek with humor, but two of their board members are legislators, and the legislators spend a lot of time raising money for themselves and probably not enough time raising money for the trust. So in recognition of that a little bit, two more non-legislative members can help in that regard. Secondly, during the February 2008 supplemental session, the legislature authorized the use of cultural license plate revenues for marketing and promotion of the trust. This bill, House Bill 2740, requests permission for continued use of this revenue stream for 10 years to continue the trust's marketing efforts. Finally, one of the great accomplishments of the trust has been the development of cultural coalitions in every county and federally recognized tribe in Oregon. Each cultural coalition must have an approved cultural plan in place in order to receive grant funds from the trust. House Bill 2740 clarifies that requirement. It's coincidental today that we had a little bit of discussion on the Cultural Trust on the House floor, and of course we're making some hard decisions out there. I think this bill serves to help us make some easier decisions right here, things that we can address immediately. All of us have trust projects in our district. I just want to list a few of mine. Oregon's Cultural Trust is unique in the nation and is truly an innovative way for all Oregonians to support their cultural values. In my district, the trust has invested in the Lakewood, or close to my district, the trust has invested in the Lakewood Center for the Arts, the Art Gem at Melhurst University, Friends of Timberline Lodge Amphitheater Project, OPB's Oregon Experience, History Series at the Tualatin Historical Society, and Artist in the Forest Project, sponsored by Friends of Tryon Creek State Park. I have watched, I've been a very proud member of this board, and I've watched the trust grow and invest funds in every county and corner of Oregon, and I would urge your support and passage of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, and I represent the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, which is sort of the lobby arm, including the Cultural Trust, the Arts Commission, the Oregon Historical Society, a group of entities interested in supporting arts, heritage, and humanities across Oregon. We're fully in support of House Bill 2740. It does exactly what Representative Bruin just outlined, and good bill should pass.
Thank you. Are there questions?
So sorry, Mr. Chair, but I have to ask the representative, if we do this, what guarantee do we have that none of the money will be used to subsidize Hannah Montana tickets?
That's a different committee.
Oh, questions sorry. Lost on this committee.
Yeah, the chair's right here. I'm sorry, withdrawn, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilling. Are there other questions? You've done a good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on 2740 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2225. I have a number of people signed up to testify. I think we should start with Bob Gillespie, Bob Rindy, and John Van Landingham. Here they come.
And as you gentlemen get started and get settled, a summary, please.
Certainly. HB 2225 directs the Department of Land Conservation and Development, working with the Housing and Community Services Department, other state agencies, and local governments to establish and implement an affordable housing pilot program. Grants the Land Conservation and Development Commission, working with other agencies, the authority to adopt the rules to implement the pilot program, including defining affordable housing, what jurisdictions are eligible to participate in the program, minimum site qualifications, a site nomination process by local jurisdictions, and a selection process by LCDC. Establishes criteria and process for potential siting by a local jurisdiction outside of a current urban growth boundary. Sets an eligibility cap for the program of 5 sites, as well as other restrictions. Declares an emergency.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I'm appearing as the chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission in support of this bill. And we're glad to offer you an uncontroversial bill for this afternoon.
Appreciate that.
So, for those of you who don't know, I know that Representative Bailey knows, since his dad has a connection to the land use program. LCDC is a commission consisting of 7 volunteers, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. We're required to represent various parts of the state. We do. The 7 of us come from LeGrand, Central Point, Eugene, Tillamook, McMinnville, Clackamas County, and Lake Oswego. I've been a member for 9 years. I've been the chair for 5 years. Before that, I served as a volunteer on the City of Eugene Planning Commission for 12 and a half years. In my real job, I have worked for 30 years as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County, representing low-income tenants, and I usually appear before you advocating for affordable housing. Thank you very much for the document recording fee increase. And mobile home parks, where I seem to find myself too frequently in front of Representative Hovey. With me are Bob Gillespie from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, who's going to talk after me briefly about the need for affordable housing, and also Bob Rindy, who is a senior planner with the DLCD, and who hopefully is not going to talk unless you ask complicated land use questions or details. And we're going to try and stay away from the details and do an overview. I'm going to talk briefly about where the bill came from, what's in the bill, and then I'm hopeful that, as we talked about with the chair earlier, that he'll bring me back to answer questions that are raised, because there are people who have questions and concerns about the bill. I've given you a 4-page handout. The first page describes sort of where the bill came from. Do you all have it?
No. We don't yet.
No, we're not yet.
Looking to see if perhaps it's on its way.
Sorry.
That's fine.
So the first page of that handout is a summary of how we got here. The second and third pages are a summary of what's in the bill, and the fourth page is a list of possible ideas that LCDC might consider for rulemaking to further define Goal 10. I'll talk some more about that. So this bill starts with an assumption. And the work that led up to it starts with an assumption, and that is that land costs are a significant problem for the development of affordable housing. The area in which I live, Lane County, the cost for an acre of multifamily, medium-density residential land has gone from about $20,000 in 1980 to about $500,000 last year. I'm not here to debate the causes of that. I know that's a complicated debate. My own personal view is that the land use program has some responsibility for that by limiting supply. I think there are greater factors that cause that, including demand, although the land use program might impact that as well by helping to make our cities great places to live. But that's not the point of the bill. The bill assumes that land costs are significant. And given that, the bill is trying to find a way to address that. Because if we don't, for affordable housing development, there are only 3 things that an affordable housing developer can do. Get more subsidy. That means a public source, typically. Raise the rents. Or not do the project. And at some point, if you raise the rents, the project isn't worth doing because low-income people can't afford it. So, faced with that, I've thought about this for years. Are there ways that we can use the land use program to help address the costs of affordable housing? Because right now, Goal 10 doesn't do that. Goal 10, the housing goal. So LCDC created a work group more than a year ago. The members of that work group included affordable housing developers, nonprofits, and for-profits, advocacy groups, private land use attorneys and planners, manufactured housing manufacturers, two city planners, planning directors of Springfield and Redmond, both of whom have expressed some interest in pursuing this idea if it's allowed, the chair of the State Housing Council, who's a home builder from Ashland, staff from the Housing and Community Services Department, Bob Gillespie, Bob Rindy staff, that work group, Farm Bureau, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, home builders, realtors, and bankers. So that work group met. Its last meeting was February 23rd. The printed bill doesn't reflect the last version that we worked through. The work group did not reach consensus, and some of the work group members are here today to oppose. So the revised bill is also in front of you. It is at the top, it shows March 3rd proposed DLCD revisions. And all of my references are going to be to that and not to the printed bill. We give Barbara Allen that outline, I hope. And the second, third pages of my handout have references, cites to the actual provisions of the proposed revised bill. Clearly, the land use program is complicated. That's not a surprise to anybody. And so the bill has to be complicated to do anything about the land use program. But the concept here is pretty simple, if we can make it happen. And that concept is to allow, not require, but allow up to five cities to add land of no more than 50 acres for each of those five cities to the urban growth boundaries in an expedited and simplified process, so long as some or all of that land is dedicated and used for affordable housing development, including a new manufactured home park. In my view, you will not see a new manufactured home park in this state, in most places in this state, unless we do something like this to produce low-cost land. LCDC is required to adopt rules setting forth defining the details, including the process and the criteria, and we must ensure that the pilot projects include a range of cities and housing types. This could be described as, I have been describing it, as voluntary inclusionary zoning. There's a state statute that the legislature adopted some time ago that preempts mandatory inclusionary zoning, in which cities might require home builders or developers to include a certain percentage of their units as affordable. This is a trial only. I'm going to say that again later. This is a trial only. There's a sunset. There's a required evaluation of the trial. And the point is to see whether this idea might work. Let me run through quickly what's in the bill, just to help you understand it. So again, this is the second, third pages of my handout. Up to five cities. None are required to participate. If cities don't like it, they don't have to do it. Metro and metro cities are excluded. We understand that Metro opposes the concept. So fine, they don't have to do it. Sites are limited to no more than 50 acres. All or part of each site must be dedicated to affordable housing. LCDC is required to do rulemaking to establish the process by January 31 of 2010, so roughly a year from now. Interested cities must submit proposals to LCDC and DLCD within 3 months after the rulemaking is completed. LCDC must pick up to five cities within 3 months after that. The rules sunset, in other words, the deal goes away, after those five, or at least those five can continue to do it, but we can't do more after those five cities are acknowledged and have amended in UGB. There's a lot of criteria here. We've tried to build in enough criteria to address concerns raised by folks who are nervous about this idea. And those criteria include requiring that each city who wants to do it show a need for affordable housing. We're not talking about the standard housing needs analysis that's usually required for an urban growth boundary expansion. Housing Community Services has data already developed on the housing needs in every city in the state. The city has to show steps it's already taken to promote affordable housing. So what have they already done to try to solve the affordable housing problem? It has to show steps that it will take to protect that site for the long term. It has to be a specific site that they have in mind. They're going to have to show that they're going to include citizen involvement in the process that they follow in doing this. They're going to have to give us a schedule of what they're doing. They're going to have to monitor and report to DLCD about how it works. The sites must be near or reasonably available in the near future to schools, employment, roads. And the pilot projects have to reflect a range of cities and parts of the state and housing types. So one housing type might be a new manufactured home park. Another one might be what's called workforce housing. Another one might be rental housing. Another one might be homeownership housing. And then we have to define, the LCDC has to define affordable housing, and there would be different definitions for those different types. What's affordable for a homeownership program is different from what's affordable for a rental housing program. And LCDC must ensure that the projects are dedicated to affordable housing for up to 50 years, at least 50 years. The rules that LCDC would adopt would allow an expedited process for adding land to the urban growth boundary. That's the carrot for the land offer. We can't, although that cannot be high-value farmland or high-value forest land, that's not the right term, but it's a shorthand for it. We are required to evaluate it. We are required to report to you every session between now and 2015, and that evaluation must include its impact on farm and forest land, on other goals, on the provision of affordable housing, on urban services. In other words, is it working? Is it doing bad things? And then finally, as I said earlier, LCDC is directed also to adopt rules on things cities might want to do or might be required to do, very different, to further Goal 10. And the last page of my handout is a list of possible ideas there. Those ideas range from very simple to very complicated and controversial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gillespie, did you want to have some comments as well?
I have a few great comments, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I am Bob Gillespie, the Housing Division Administrator for Oregon Housing Community Services, and I'm here today to testify in favor of 2225. As the state's housing finance agency, it's our vision to ensure that all Oregonians have housing that meets their needs. And during the last year, the executive committee of the department traveled to all parts of the state and met with community members. And there was a recurring theme that we heard throughout the state of Oregon about an imbalance between the cost of housing within a community and the people that work in those communities, a jobs housing imbalance. And we heard many instances of cases where people that have good, well-paying jobs don't have the ability to live in the communities in which they work. Some examples, and one that was repeated at our committee meetings with Ashland, you have people that are commuting from White City to work there. Hood River, you have people commuting in from Washington. In Bend, we heard that people are commuting from Madras to work in Bend. And then up and down the Oregon coast, you have the greatest disparity between the cost of housing and the jobs. And it's not just a low-income issue, it's a median household issue. You have people, teachers, city administrators, emergency support staff that can't afford to live in the communities that they're working in. And we, too, would like to see these pilots to test the assumption that you can get the land at a lower cost and therefore make the housing more affordable and more readily available to workforce and also special needs housing, those that can't afford to pay for housing, such as the chronically mentally ill or the development disabled. We also like the notion of the 50 years of affordability. If we're funding this, we can add our restrictions to that to help ensure the enforcement of that. But that would enable there to be housing for these working families for generations to come. And John also mentioned the research that we did on housing needs. We've done that both for rental workforce housing and for special needs populations. And in the upcoming year, we're going to be looking at the commuting patterns around the state to determine those cities where there is the largest imbalance between the housing that's available and the number of people that have to commute into those cities. And we'd be anxious to share this information with DLCD to assist them in making the decision about pilot communities and as a part of the assessment of the need. And I think it also affords us an opportunity to work with both the five pilot communities and others to help them understand what their affordable housing needs are and what they might do besides these five pilot programs. And that concludes my testimony. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today and represent Housing Community Services and answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. I had just one quick question that I'm eager to hear what the committee has to ask. I noticed in your testimony, Mr. Van Lanningham, and you've mentioned that the land needs to be, some or all of the land is dedicated to affordable housing development. I quick skim through. I didn't see how that's defined. How is some defined?
Mr. Chair, it's not. It's left to LCDC to define that.
Okay. Thank you.
I honestly feel that we'd better to have that in rule and not in statute.
That's fine. Just wanted to make sure I understood. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So has anyone of the opponents suggested a rush of folks to follow suit, first this group and then another and another, anyone that can get less expensive land, or are you the only one pursuing this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, you're anticipating correctly, and I believe one of the concerns you will hear is that there are other important and land uses that might want to do this same thing, such as schools in your community or churches. Our response would be that we are trying very hard here to build in safeguards and to treat this as a trial. I think schools are a bit different because typically you want a lot of residential homes around schools, so you're talking about probably a greater impact. But I have to admit that the point is a valid point.
And I'm just curious, of course it is a trial device, but I just wonder how you are going to control the pricing of the land you hope to buy cheaply. Is it? Do you have some sort of a technique you can share with us, or are you going to surprise folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the Housing Community Service Department has a long history of ensuring that land that is designated for affordable housing use has to stay that way through contract. And we haven't done the detail, but let me give an example. Let's say that the city of Sisters proposes to bring in a 30-acre site. Sisters is interested in this concept if they're allowed to do it. Land in Sisters costs a lot of money. It's hard to find housing for workforce people in Sisters. So let's say they find a 30-acre site. We might require that 10 acres of that site be dedicated for affordable housing. The developer would then, the owner of the land, would be able to use the other 20 acres for market rate housing. That's how the developer finances the concept and can afford to give us, in voluntary inclusionary zoning, the 10 acres, bluntly. So with that 10 acres, we would probably, we would require the city to show us how they want to use it, who would use it, and we would have a contract with the city, and we would try to identify affordable housing developers, whether that, in my community that would be St. Vincent de Paul, NEDCO, the Housing Authority, various groups like that, and get definitions from them of what kind of project they're going to do. You wouldn't want to put apartments on 10 acres. That's too big for an affordable housing development. But you might have a manufactured housing park. You might have an apartment complex of 40 units. You might have some home ownership units. So it's hard to be specific about what would exactly we require.
Thank you for that. But is the reduced price driven by the design you just explained to us, or is it driven by the fact that you're able to utilize land that otherwise wouldn't, might be EFU land or something else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, both. Again, nobody's required to do this. So a city would have to find a landowner who's interested in doing it. And if the landowner is interested in doing it, then we're saying to the landowner, here's your carrot. You get part of the land to do whatever you want with, presumably market rate housing. And you get to add it to the boundary quicker and cheaper. So you save money that way. And in exchange for that, you're going to give us something. That's why I'm calling it voluntary inclusionary zoning. It's a carrot, not a stick.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Van, I couldn't tell if you were raising your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Lanningham, my line of questioning is similar to Representative Benz, slightly different tack. We asked about future potential other uses of that kind of land and other uses that might want exceptions. What else already exists? Are there land uses that are urban land uses that already exist to which we provide exemptions to the urban growth boundary?
Chair Reed, Representative Bailey, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I would note, however, that it's not, this is an, as an experiment, it's not dissimilar from the experiment that the legislature approved last session, allowing urban and rural reserves.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So if we don't currently allow exceptions to UGB for urban use, and it does seem likely that there are potentially a list of suitors for such exemptions, industrial land springs to mind that is seeking cheap land perhaps on the periphery, and there might be a lack of it in cities. What are the criteria for defining which types of uses shall be eligible for pilots for exceptions to the UGB? Why affordable housing?
Chair Reed, Representative Bailey, why affordable housing? For me, the answer is because that's what I do for a living, and that's what I believe in, and that's what I've spent the last 30 years advocating for, and that's why I got involved in land use planning in the first place with the City of Eugene. The City of Eugene has done every possible, in my view, step it could take under the current land use program, as well as putting money where its mouth is, and we still have an affordable housing problem. And land still costs, as I described earlier, a huge amount of money. So are there other things that we could do? Are there other things that we could do? I'm open to improving the land use program. I'm not trying to suggest this is the only thing that could be done to improve the land use program. I think there are lots of things that could be done to improve the land use program. This is but one.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
And, Mr. Van Lanningham, I appreciate and honor your commitment to affordable housing. It's an extremely important issue in this state. I'm curious, will there be a process or some other method by which we will designate criteria for looking at these types of pilots in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I don't have that, and I don't know that there are no criteria now for other things that might come before you. There are no other proposals within LCDC or DLCD to come forward with those things. I'm out of here in 2 years, so who knows what happens after that. I can assure you I won't be back trying this again. It was too hard already.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Van Lendingham, thank you for bringing us another revolutionary, perhaps consensus or perhaps not consensus concept. I'm curious, since you're not going to be around for another 2 years, I'm just kind of curious about the 50-year, period of time that this land will remain for affordable housing. So I guess my concern is that after that 50 years, do we have another affordable housing crisis when this land then converts to a higher and better use?
Have you guys dealt with that?
Not really, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Holdy, we have not thought beyond 50 years. You and I will be dead. Maybe Representative Reed will not be.
Granted, but we hope.
Sorry, dude.
We haven't thought about that.
Turkey,
and current housing community services, I turn to Bob Gillespie, because current housing community services programs that fund affordable housing development typically require 30 to 50 years of affordability, and we haven't thought beyond requiring beyond that. You talk about the useful life of an affordable housing project. It probably is going to have to get refinanced after 50 years to rehabilitate it, but we haven't thought.
Chair Reed, Representative Holvey, we do have standards that we do want developments built to, and we try to develop to a standard so they are sustainable for a long duration. And, I don't have a crystal ball to know in 50 years what these developments are going to look like, and I'm sure that, they will, if they're going to maintain their affordability, they will take some reinvestment. But we do have the long look in mind, and the fact that we don't want it to be just any type of housing. We do want it to be something that is sustainable.
Well, thank you. Well, I guess that's just why I brought that up, is that, from reading this bill, I would guess that in 50 years there's no need for affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So, it seems to be a premise in the bill. That's the only reason I mention it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
If I might please ask you to consider a couple things as you hear the testimony going forward. One thing is to note, we're not here as anti-land use planning people. This is not your typical one side versus the other side. I've done this for almost 20 years as a volunteer. Bob Brindy has dedicated his whole professional life to doing this. So this is something that we think allows us to look at the land use program and try things. I love the land use program. I don't think it's perfect. I think that improving the land use program requires taking some risks and trying some flexibility. The risk here, if we're wrong, the risk is that five cities will have added up to 50 acres to the urban growth boundaries early. And we will have failed to help affordable housing. That's the risk. If you think that's too great a risk, that's your decision. We could go lower. We could say up to three cities. We could say 30 acres. But we're trying to design something that will test this hypothesis about, is there a way to use the program to get to cheaper land? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Lanningham. I appreciate that introduction. I appreciate your willingness to stick around, too, so I suspect we might get into some more detailed questions. Next up, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Sean Cleave, and Peggy Lynch, please. Leave it to you to decide who goes first.
You go ahead, Mary.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy. I'm a staff attorney with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends is a nonprofit land use organization that's been around for over 30 years. And over those 30 years, we have been very involved with the crafting of rules and statutes regarding affordable housing and with representing nonprofit housing organizations, Native American tribes, and others to ensure that those rules and statutes are enforced. We were also a member of the committee that had, that discussed the bill that's currently before you. Land use planning alone cannot guarantee affordable housing. Financing and other tools are often needed. But without the underpinning of appropriate zoning for all types of housing, there's not even the possibility of affordability. We believe the land use program can and should do more to support affordable housing. This is not about whether there's a need for more affordable housing statewide. There is. However, we believe that House Bill 2225 will not address this issue. In fact, we are concerned that it will merely delay the meaningful work that does need to be undertaken by the Department of Land Conservation and Development to effectively address affordable housing. HB 2225 would allow two fundamental changes in Oregon's land use planning program regarding urban growth boundaries. First, it will allow up to five cities to expand their urban growth boundaries without a showing that they need land for additional residential housing. And those cities can expand the land that can expand onto farmland, even if there are other alternative sites available that are not zoned for exclusive farm use. Pitting affordable housing needs against the farming community sets up a false conflict that's bad for both goals. Under Oregon's Land Use Planning Statewide Goal 10, housing, and various statutes, all cities are supposed to provide, through their land use codes and plans, land for the housing types to meet all of its citizens' needs. While not everyone on the DLCD working group agreed on House Bill 2225, we all did agree on one thing, and that is that DLCD needs to adopt rules, policies, incentives, and guidelines, and other tools to flesh out just what it means for a city to provide for the housing needs of all, and that this is a task that's long overdue. 1,000 Friends and the Oregon Home Builders Association jointly developed a list of topics and ideas for how local zoning codes and plans could remove barriers to affordable housing and encourage less expensive housing inside existing urban growth boundaries. That list is attached to my testimony. We believe this is a good starting point for such a policy effort by DLCD. It's not the definitive list, and some of the ideas on that list will have widespread support, and others will generate a lot more heated discussion. But these are the discussions that must take place and which will ultimately result in a land use program that ensures every city is doing its share to provide for the housing needs of all inside their existing urban growth boundaries. But this will not happen because we are concerned House Bill 2225 will divert staff of DLCD and the Housing and Community Services Department to a scheme that we find very problematic. In addition to the core problem already mentioned of allowing UGB expansions onto farmland without a showing of need, We believe it proposes a rather complicated process for a newfangled idea that, even if successful, may have little impact on the number of affordable housing units ultimately built. Among other things, as has already been mentioned, the bill does not mention the number or percentage of affordable housing units that should be built or how affordable the housing must be. From our perspective, House Bill 2225 is an easy short-term fix. Easy because rather than developing a program that requires all cities to undertake a thorough evaluation of whether their land use codes hinder or encourage affordable housing, it brings in new, temporarily cheap land at the edge of a UGB. But it's cheap only once because it lacks infrastructure, water, sewer, roads. These lands will currently be in farming, and they will not have infrastructure. All of that has to be paid for and maintained, and then the land does not look quite so inexpensive. DLCD's affordable housing program should be focused on providing land use and transportation tools for affordable housing inside the existing UGB where people already live or want to live because it's near their jobs or school and it's where the infrastructure already exists. It should not be focused on placing affordable housing at the edge of communities. If House Bill 2225 were amended to simply direct DLCD to do this, undertake a policy analysis of the tools needed from the land use and transportation system to contribute to the provision of affordable housing inside existing UGBs, we could support it, but in its current form, it doesn't do that. There's another much more simple possibility for a bill, which would be a bill that simply drops the current preemption on inclusionary zoning as a local tool and allow that to be used in UGB expansions. There are other simpler ways to address this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cleave?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau on various issues, including land use. Thanks for the time today to bring up this issue. I'd just like, for the record, to thank Chair John Van Landingham for the work he did during the interim on this rather complicated issue. He represented a balance to a very diverse group, and the conversation was always cordial, so I'd like to publicly thank him for that. Oregon Farm Bureau is an organization in Oregon that makes up nearly 8,000 farming and ranching families. We have over 4,700 associate members statewide. Land use is a big component. Our Oregon's land use system is a big component of what makes Oregon's farming and ranching families successful. We have been an advocate for Oregon's land use system, a system that purposefully keeps agricultural land at lower prices so that land can be purchased and farmed. When you're talking about UGB expansions and development for a variety of reasons, whether they be commercial or residential, and you have a system that keeps your input costs, such as labor and supplies, relatively fixed, the third leg of that stool is land prices. And of course, if you can buy land at a lower price, that increases your margin. It's pretty simple math. But the land use system is only one component of an overarching program that should be developed in Oregon to encourage and incentivize low-income housing. And I'm here today to testify in opposition to the bill 2225 as it's currently written. Oregon Farm Bureau is more than happy to continue the discussion around affordable housing, and of course UGB expansions would likely be a continued component of that discussion, but as written, we can't support 2225 today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Lynch. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation in government. The League strongly supports both the state's land use goals and meeting the housing needs of households at every income level. League members attended nearly all of DLCD's affordable housing work group meetings and appreciate the leadership of Chair Van Landingham and the thoughtful consideration of the work group devoted to this proposal. We understand the need for developing new approaches to increasing the supply of affordable units. In the League's view, however, it is premature to enact a pilot program that sidesteps the normal process for bringing land into a city's urban growth boundary. LCDC instead should focus its attention on implementation and rulemaking on Goal 10. The work group discussed a number of steps communities could be taking to increase the stock of affordable housing within existing boundaries. Given the state's focus on global climate change and peak oil, compact growth and development of complete communities within urban growth boundaries should be a priority. Furthermore, DLCD's increased workload due to Measure 49 claims, the potential impact of changes to the state's land use system, and the state's dire financial situation are other reasons to delay action on this proposal. Meeting the housing needs of Oregonians has become increasingly difficult. We urge the legislature to take a fresh look at inclusionary zoning. It has proved a valuable tool to increasing the affordable housing supplies in other states. I'd like to make a couple of personal comments. Number one, your seven-member land conservation and development commission is perhaps one of the most hardworking volunteer groups I have ever seen. They not only have worked on this proposal, but they are working to develop new rules related to urban growth boundary expansions in a reasonable manner, and they continue on a biennial basis to have a policy setting agenda. A couple of years ago, they increased and did rulemaking on Goal 9 for economic reasons. So they are to be commended, and certainly Chair Van Landingham's leadership has been a great part of that. So it's with difficulty, as somebody who, and as the League, who has been big supporters of affordable housing, that we come here and ask that you not pass this bill. I also want to recognize the Housing and Community Development Department. The increasing statistics that they have that provide us with the information about income levels and housing needs by income levels throughout the state will be increasingly important as our communities move forward. But DLCD has limited staff. They have, it is probably one of the smallest agencies that you deal with, approximately 60 people plus Measure 49 people. A 20% decrease in their budget would mean a loss of 12, a 30% a loss of 18 people. This session, more than any other, you are going to have to prioritize the kinds of issues that this department deals with. And one of the things that they are charged with doing is beginning to do periodic review with our local cities throughout the state, including cities such as Forest Grove, Hermiston, The Dalles, Roseburg, Milwaukee, Pendleton, Sherwood, and Tualatin, just to name a few. It is at that point where comprehensive plans are reviewed. We see whether or not we have enough land to deal with all of our needs, our residential needs, our commercial needs, our industrial needs, and it offers the opportunity for those cities to then look at their community development codes to see what they can do, and remember that list on page 4 of Chair Van Landingham's, to see which of those things they can do legally within the context of their communities to adopt new rules that will allow them to make sure that they have complete communities within their cities. Affordable housing is for people who have multiple needs, as we all do. But if you think of the kinds of extra transit needs, the needs for a variety of services, we need to have affordable housing in the midst of our community, not on the edge. Unless you think I have a prejudice against manufacturing home parks, my in-laws live in one, and my mother lived in one, so I certainly don't have a problem with those either.
Appreciate the suggestion that you have a good relationship with your in-laws, too.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you for your comments, and particularly for your kind words about the commission. We obviously depend on volunteer service throughout the state. The questions for the panel.
Representative Patrick.
I guess I didn't pick up on it, but could you clarify for me, did you see the proposed DLCD amendments? Okay, and so you still don't like those?
Yeah, we have, since we have followed the work group, these amendments have come forward as they have worked through the process. So our testimony at least still stands based on the amendments as seen.
Yeah, Chair Van Landingham had, had a very open process. The amendments are a product of the work group. Don't take those as something that the department had developed in-house and we hadn't seen. And we had offered suggestions for improvements of the language. I think, especially from the Farm Bureau's perspective, I can't speak to the other two on the dais here, but just an overall policy position, just of how we're going about implementing this low-income housing, using specifically and primarily the land use system as a means to accomplish those goals. That's the objection, not necessarily the language of the bill.
Would it be fair to say that if the amendments and the proposals were adopted, you'd be closer?
From my perspective, I was speaking also as the former panel did to the amended proposal.
Understood. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel, Don Miner, Art Schlack, and Stephen Kafori, please.
I'll go first then. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of this concept. For many, many years, manufactured housing, particularly in parks, has been an important source of affordable housing in this state. Even today, housing tens and tens of thousands of people. But at least in the last 6 or 8 years, there have been few, if any, new parks built in the state. In fact, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing rental parks close, and the folks living in those parks dispossessed. Now, that's relatively new. For those of us who've lived in the state for very many years, you're familiar with old mobile home parks that seem to go on forever and ever and ever, and providing affordable housing to families of lower income. Today, we're seeing even new communities that are 6, 8 years old close, and the folks being forced to move their homes, no place to move them to. Last session, Representative Holby's committee dealt with some of the consequences of this with the cooperation of the Park Owners Association. Some financial support was provided, but today, no new parks are being built. I think Mr. Van Landingham predicted that under the current circumstances, it's unlikely that any new ones will be built. And that'll have consequences to our industry, but also to Oregonians who will be denied this important source of non-government subsidized affordable housing. This is a very, very modest proposal. It's 5 projects, none of which can be more than 50 acres, and we heard in the work group that some of those could be 5 or 10 acres. So it's a very, very modest proposal. There isn't a lot of detail to this. That's left to be done by rule, but those rules will be adopted to the Housing Council and LCDC, both, I think, very, very trustworthy agencies. I'd like to see the proposal go forward just to see if there are any things that can be done to provide more affordable housing and more affordable land within UGBs. And with that, I'll close my remarks.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We are land use planners that work both for government and private industry. We also have land use lawyers and other kinds of planners, such as transportation planners. Global warming. You hear almost everybody talking this morning about the advantages of and the benefits of affordable housing for those people who live in those affordable housing units. But affordable housing benefits everybody. The last thing we need in the state is more people having to live further and further away from their jobs, as is happening all the time, and having to travel back and forth and back and forth, polluting our air, causing our transportation facilities to be overcrowded, and causing global warming. And we have not done very much, and we are hoping this year to do more in some other bills, on trying to tie the concerns about global warming and our concerns with land use planning together, because they're really intrinsically entwined. This bill goes one step towards that. It's not our planner's favorite bill this session. It's a small step. We do support it. We would rather see, in addition, elimination of the restrictive prohibition on inclusive zoning. But this is the bill we have in front of us today, and we do support it.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Art Slock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. House Bill 2225 is well-intended, and I certainly want to commend those that have had this discussion about affordable housing. However, land costs are only an element of really the cost of the development of any site, whether it's in an urban growth boundary or even whether it's adjacent, going to be brought in, or even outside of an urban growth boundary. It's really the question of the services that are also paramount to developing the land that is part of the land costs, the development of the site, whether it has sanitation, water, whether it has good transportation, whether it has transit available to it. All of those things are necessary for affordable housing. And so just to think that putting a greenfield next to an urban growth boundary and saying it's going to now provide affordable housing when you haven't thought about the services that either have to be extended or provided to get to the point of truly the cost of that ground for development is something I think that is not taken fully into consideration when you look at this bill. Certainly, lands that have all those services available is more expensive than land that doesn't. But when you bring those services there, things begin to level out and are more on par in terms of the development costs. Affordable housing is kind of like beauty. It's in the eyes of the beholder. And I would submit to you that if we are going to go down the road of providing special considerations for affordable housing, then the legislature needs to define what that is so that we have a common understanding of that and that we not delegate that to a rulemaking process, because I would submit that at some point we're probably going to be back before the legislature trying to get the legislature to address what maybe was done by rule a couple of years earlier. Another piece that I think that should be in statute should you go down this course is that most projects that are identified as affordable housing have a small percentage of affordable housing actually within that project. And here again we're talking about some percentage being affordable, and whether that's 5%, 10%, 15%, it could be just a very few units that would be said to be affordable, where the majority of them might be units that might be 3,000, 4,000 square foot houses and the like, which we all might think are not affordable housing, even though somebody in this room might say that a $500,000 house is their definition of what's affordable. So those things, I think, you know, are a concern about how we move forward. Finally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to express a concern that there are at least a half a dozen bills in tracking through the legislature this session in various committees that would require the Department of Land Conservation and Development and LCDC to do rulemaking. I am, and this is one of them, I am extremely concerned with respect to the budget of DLCD given these, shall we say, trying times, and whether the department will actually be able to undertake all the rulemaking that it would be subject to these bills if they all pass. I would submit to you that there really is, at least from our perspective, two priorities that the department should have at this point in time. One is to complete the Measure 49 claims. That should be first and foremost. The second one is something that we've talked about for years and have done very little with, and I think it is a major factor with this question of affordable housing, and that is the department needs to address, and we need to address, the question of infrastructure and capital facilities planning, because if we are able to do that, we will not only provide for affordable housing, we will also provide for other development in a more equitable manner inside those urban growth boundaries, which we have all coveted, and which we have a lot of land currently within those boundaries that do not have the services, the infrastructure, that are necessary for them to develop. And those are two priorities, I think, that we really need to take into consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stock. We appreciate your perspective on the local governments particularly. Are there questions, Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kfouri, you mentioned something that I want you to elaborate on a little bit. You mentioned the possibility in these pilots of energy reduction or savings to fight, you used a term, I think you might have said climate change. I'm not sure which term you used.
Global warming.
That was it. But seriously, I want to hear more about that, because it seems to me, in light of what the testimony we just heard, we might be spending more energy to put these pilots in place. Doesn't mean we wouldn't learn something from them, but I'm wondering what you think about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, my major concern is that what's happening presently is people are, because the cost of land is going up and the cost of housing is going up, well, actually going down, but over a longer period of time, the last 10 years, shall we say, price of housing going up, people have been required to move further and further away from downtown. And anybody who travels, it doesn't have to be Portland, you could outside of Salem, go home and look where are people living that are working here in the Capitol building. They're not living in Salem. They're living quite a ways away, and they have to commute back and forth every day. And that phenomenon is increasing across the state. And part of that reason is because the housing is getting expensive the closer in you go. So if we can build our affordable housing or design our planning so that affordable housing is built inside urban growth boundaries, and obviously the closer to services the better, closer to jobs the better, then we will reduce that necessity for people to travel back and forth. And you heard some other people testify about the problem of if this bill goes into effect and all the new affordable housing goes in on the edges of the city, that's better than traveling from 50 miles away, but it still may be a problem in terms of locating. And overall, the issue is we are not doing any planning right now, not nearly enough plan, where we're taking a look at what are the global warming impacts of the decisions we're making, our transportation decisions, our housing decisions, our infrastructure decisions. We're just not putting that in the back of our mind. What's the global warming implication of this decision? And I think we need to be thinking about that in all our... And the other land use committee that is taking a look at the Big Look Task Force bill, our planning association is recommending that they have that as a primary guiding principle in their planning, so that all planning across the state begins more to take a look at that issue.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking about that point, because I was actually thinking of this sort of the opposite. I was thinking that this might require folks that would be eligible for low income to move further, but you're saying this might be just the opposite. With these pilots, they might actually be closer to services and jobs. It just seems to me that the way it's designed, I could be wrong, what I'm hearing is a sort of, if you build it, they will come, but the pilot may have some great elements to it, but what do we do about the services that folks need in those pilots?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, the issue you're talking about is, are we going to be doing this planning for where this low-income housing is going to be located in a vacuum? And that is obviously a concern. That if you say, all right, we've got some acreage on the edge of town that might be suitable for building low-income housing, before that decision is made, and I assume that LCDC is going to have some rules on this if they ever get a chance to make any rules, that will say that when you're deciding where those are going to be, that there are other things you're going to take into consideration besides just, is the land cheap and is it available?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bailey.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Kafoury, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, Mr. Kafoury, give a sense of just ballpark magnitude of what percent of commuters are commuters that are commuting between UGB areas because of a lack of affordable housing in one UGB versus another?
Not a very specific question.
I have the foggiest idea. I'm sorry. I'm just a poor lobbyist.
It's a good question. It's very interesting. You had a follow-up?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure that I could get that answer for you. I know that the state and local governments, and there are a lot of transportation planners around who could get that information. I don't have the top of my head, and I'd be happy to get it for you in short order.
I would be curious. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. And given that this bill does not apply to the Portland metro area, is my understanding, and its suburbs. I'm curious to the degree to which, in your opinion, this bill would have positive contributions to global warming over and above, say, a solution to affordable housing that addresses the need within urban growth boundaries at a comprehensive scale within the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, this bill is it's a pilot. And I think there are a lot of questions that are not answered yet. And we're going to have to see how this works out. I think some of the questions have been raised earlier. Is this going to be 5-acre plots or are they going to be 50-acre plots? How far are they going to be from other services? Are we going to have infrastructure available or not? We don't know yet. This is a pilot program, and I think when we come back in 2 years, we'll have some answers for you.
There are no further questions, Representative Holden.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who can answer this question, maybe Mr. Van Landingham, but the point was brought up about, what percentage of the land in these projects will actually be dedicated to affordable housing, and realizing that the price of the land in the areas and the developer might be able to get out of other development inside this to help subsidize the affordable housing stock inside that project, it seems like there ought to be some sort of minimum requirement as to what percentage of land in these projects is going to affordable housing.
That was a question I asked. I don't think that's necessarily directed at any of you unless you had one to make a comment about it. That's a question I asked, and I think it is worth further conversation. Perhaps we'll have a chance for Mr. Van Landingham to come back up and conclude. If there aren't other questions for this panel, we have three more people aware of the time. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Janet Jarvis, John Chandler, and you didn't see it. You two get to finish up, please.
What's worse? I have to leave his chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Mr. Chandler has graciously allowed me to speak first, so I don't have to follow him again today.
That's always a good strategy.
As I did this morning. So, yes, thank you. I find myself in the unique position today of being here in support of Chair Van Landingham's proposal and DLCD's request for you to move this bill forward. We understand that the draft that you receive is still a work in progress, but conceptually, this is something that the Oregon Association of Realtors would like to work alongside the department with. I think the largest issue for us is that I don't think we understand all of the issues that impact the development of affordable housing. And I think it was best said when it was mentioned earlier that these are 5 pilot programs, up to 50 acres each, so a total of 250 acres in this entire state. Maybe some of these projects would work well, maybe some of them wouldn't, but maybe we would learn a great deal out of this experiment that would help us be able to set policy into the future. future. There's been a lot of discussion about we need to do rulemaking on Goal 10 first. I'm not sure we know the answers in all cases for the rulemaking on Goal 10. And so my hope is that you as a committee will at least keep this concept alive while we continue to work on it this session.
Thank you very much. The anticipation builds here. We've all been waiting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 2225. It is a work in progress. We do need some additional discussions. We hope you will keep it airborne long enough to have those discussions take place. A couple things I wanted to talk about with regard to the testimony you've heard and the concepts in this bill. One is the idea of inclusionary zoning, which is sort of jargon for those of you who aren't land use buffs. Inclusionary zoning of the mandatory sort is where a local government is allowed to require of developers, builders, to set aside a certain number of or a certain percentage of a project for affordable housing. It has been used in California, it's been used in Maryland and other places around the country. I would dispute that it's worked well in those places. There are conflicting studies. What we did back a number of years ago was this legislature passed a bill saying you could not do mandatory inclusionary zoning, but you could do voluntary inclusionary zoning. I'm obviously summarizing the legislative language. That was probably, I think, 10 or a dozen years ago. We've been waiting for the voluntary inclusionary zoning to start happening. Inclusionary zoning of a voluntary sort would be a situation similar to what's been contemplated by this bill, where a deal could be struck of a sort between a local government and a willing developer to, in exchange for certain things. It could be an urban growth boundary expansion, it could be different standards inside the boundary, it could be higher density, faster timing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then the developer would, on their own, voluntarily provide housing units at a more affordable price because they could make the project pencil. One of the things that's unique about Oregon and the reason we addressed the problem the way we did was we don't have big builders here. We don't have big 1,000-acre parcels, subdivisions like you do in other states. The average subdivision, I think sometime last year I heard this number, was around 20 units in Oregon, 20 lots. I will note that we're doing our part for affordable housing involuntarily as we speak, and there's a lot of those lots still sitting out there. But on a 20-lot subdivision, it's much more difficult to do mandatory inclusionary zoning than it is on a several thousand lot subdivision. I still would quarrel about the underlying theory, but the practicality is much more difficult with small builders. We then were looking to a more voluntary system where we could partner up with the local government to address some of the things that got in the way of providing affordable housing in the first place. In some cases, it is land supply, which is where the urban growth boundary comes in. It doesn't have to be urban growth boundary expansions. It could be underutilized land inside the boundary, differently wrongly zoned or miszoned or underzoned property inside the boundary. It could be process. It could be density. It could be neighborhood opposition. It could be appeal process. There's a whole series of things that get in the way of providing affordable housing. It's still a fact, for example, in almost every city in Oregon, I think I can say this categorically, it is still easier to do detached single family on relatively large lots than it is to do attached housing, for example. Now, not all attached housing is more affordable by definition than detached housing, but it makes it easier. The more units you can put on a piece of dirt, the lower the price per unit can be. It's still very difficult to get that through in most cities. That's the sort of thing we were hoping this discussion would lead to, not just the urban growth boundary piece, although I would echo what has been said already, that 250 acres potentially maximum around the state of Oregon would probably not bring the ag economy crashing down, but one never knows, I suppose. But of those pilot programs, not all of them would be UGB expansions, not all of them would be 50 acres, and out of them would be a very good, as Ms. Jarvis said, a very good little experiment, potentially. We think the part of this process going forward that's everybody as important as the UGB piece, in fact more important than the UGB piece, is the language hidden away in, I think, Section 10 or something of the draft in front of you, which is ideas for local governments to consider in terms of process changes, density changes, and so forth that have gotten in the way, we believe, of affordable housing. The issue, I think, is worth talking about. Right now, affordable housing isn't as big an issue because the market's crashed. Last year, 2 years ago, it was a huge issue. 2 years from now, hopefully, it'll be an issue again unless we do something. Now is probably the right time to act because it's much easier to fix it up when it rains. Right now, the real estate market is stalled. We can talk about some of the procedural things without getting in the way of investment-backed expectations necessarily. It's a good concept. We should keep it moving. I commend it to you. I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you very much. We have just a couple of minutes for questions, if anyone has any. Representative Galizio.
Thank you both for testifying. Do you, your respective groups, the realtors and the home builders, have, for lack of a better term, official positions on the UGB? Do you support or oppose the concept of an urban growth boundary? Just in general.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, we support Oregon's land use system from the home builder's perspective. I often say we started going to church somewhat late. We got there in time for the collection plate to be passed. We don't think we think the UGB has worked to our advantage. It is, I think, become enshrined in a way it was never intended. The UGB was always expected to be a land use planning tool, and as such, no more or less important than a zoning code or a subdivision code or a transportation code or anything else. It's kind of gotten elevated in the pantheon of possible land use systems. But we're not trying to get rid of it. We think it has worked, except for when it hasn't.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to echo Mr. Chandler's comments. I think as an association, we have certainly come to the table and made a lot of suggestions over the past several sessions. But as in general, we are supportive of the land use system. But it's at times have created more problems than solutions in certain categories. So, yes.
Other questions? Looks like you've stumped our panel. Thank you very much. Just as a concluding comment, it seems to me that it does look like this deserves additional conversation, and perhaps that's one of the best things we can say about it at the moment. That it, I see one other person who wants to testify. Come on forward real quickly. Just to finish my thought, it seems to be the impetus for new discussions and perhaps creative thinking, so that's a good thing. Mr. Brennan, we have a very short time, so if you'd like to have a comment, that'd be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Brennan, and I represent manufactured housing communities of Oregon, have since 1992. We have about 500 park members around the state, from as small as four spots to several hundred, and we're probably about half the number of parks. We've been providing affordable housing, as Don Miner has suggested, for a long time without a subsidy from government. It has become, over the last 10 years, prohibitive for my members to find land, pay the fees associated with it, and build a park and make any money. And we support this bill. We'd like to offer this up as a solution as we're coming to some more problems in park closures around the state. We've got a looming disaster in Springfield, where there are some parks located on very valuable ground, where several hundred people could be displaced. We'd like to have the opportunity to go in and work with the city of Springfield, bring in some developers that would see if there can be a cooperative program where some of these people could be relocated. It's just another option. I know Representative Holvey is aware of the impending problems down in that area. But MHCO supports this bill and would like to move forward with it.
Thank you, and thank you for your brevity. I imagine we'll have some additional conversation on this. Mr. Van Lanningham, do you want to make any concluding comments just before we finish up here?
You're in charge. I know you're watching the clock.
I am watching the clock. We had some folks who were lurking for the next committee, but we could probably take a minute if you wanted to make any quick comments.
I'm a quick talker.
I know. That's why I'm confident.
So let me try to, John Van Lanningham, let me try to address a couple of the concerns that were raised. I don't know that I can do them all. The first is the suggestion that LCDC should do the Goal 10 work first. That's a great idea that we do the Goal 10 work. It's in the bill. I hope that we will. It's been my goal for the 9 years I've been on the commission. It will take time. It's complicated and controversial. That list that I gave you attached to my testimony includes a number of ideas which cities will not like and will not be happy about being required to do. So it's not something that one could do blithely and quickly. I also want to note that that alone does not solve the affordability problem. I come from a city where we've done most of those things, and we still have an affordability problem. Most affordable housing projects involve at least a dozen different tools of subsidies and strategies such as reduced parking. Reducing the land cost is one way to do that. The other one I wanted to come over with is that the real problem here is infrastructure cost. I don't know how DLCD or LCDC can solve the problem of infrastructure costs. That's a funding issue. We don't have the power to affect funding. We can't do that by rule, or even if we did have the right way to do that. I agree it's a problem. No one solved that issue. I noticed that the Interim Revenue Restructuring Committee once thought of an RET, a real estate transfer tax. There isn't a great solution for that. But let me note, what's the risk here? If the project can't finance infrastructure, and we're not waiving the requirement of infrastructure, all the other goals apply to these sites. The developer or the person who's adding the site would still have to provide infrastructure. If it can't be done, it won't happen. So the land won't get developed, it won't get added to the boundary. Where's the risk there? Finally, people have talked about this being on the fringe. We're excluding Metro. We're talking about cities like Sisters and Ashland, which are small. The fringe is not very far away. And the issue of people commuting from White City into Ashland is significant. We could get those numbers. We've heard those numbers. I don't think we have statewide numbers on how far people are commuting. But there are examples of those cities where that's happening. I also want to note that mobile home parks were built on the fringes of our cities in the 1980s and 1990s. And one reason they're closing is because growth has gotten out to them. The land use program was not meant to be no growth. It's always growth. Growth will continue, we hope, someday in our state. And the future developments will have them growing out to them. We've built in requirements that LCDC consider, the availability of jobs, services, and et cetera, in considering the sites. There are other questions. I know I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a good summary and a good discussion. I imagine it will continue before too long.
Thanks.
We are adjourned.